Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Ocean Vuong's family is from Vietnam, resettling in Hartford, Connecticut as refugees in 1990 when he was 2 years old. Vuong is now a writer, a poet, and also teaches at UMass Amherst. And back in 2016, his collection of poetry called Night Sky with Exit Wounds received many accolades, including a T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry and comparisons to Emily Dickinson. His new book, his first novel, is called On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. We spoke with Ocean in studio earlier today about his writing.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you. Ocean, the book is a letter that a young boy named Little Dog writes to his illiterate mother. The family live in Hartford, Connecticut. They're refugees from the Vietnam War. Where did you get this idea, a letter to a mother, your mother, it seems, who will never read it because she can't?
Yeah, it seemed almost comically futile, the project. Why write a letter, and at that, a 240-page letter, to someone who will never receive it? But I think the very futility of it was what excited me as a writer, because when the recipient is not promised, the pressure now falls on language itself. And I think one could argue that language, particularly the English language, is another character in this book. When the project of communication fails or falters, the question then is, does language matter? Can the sentence be an architecture for our feelings? And it was ultimately the experiment of the book to venture into American life with language and see where it takes us and where it fails us, which it often does.
I will say, though, as a reader and listening to you say that, if you had posed that question to me as I closed the book when I finished it, I would have said, well, clearly this book shows that language absolutely matters.
Yes.
And that it can stand on its own to tell a story.
Yes, yes. I feel that way as a writer, as a professor of English. But I think one of the pleasures of the book is that you get your chance to orchestrate the stakes. And for a reader entering this book, you start to see that the stakes are built up towards that reality. You know, I could stand in front of an audience and say, well, language matters, and that would be fine enough. But then folks would think, well, how? Why? And I guess the book is my attempt at asking how and why.
To that point, you have said about this book that you wanted to start with the truth and end with art.
Yes.
That feels like the trajectory that you're talking about. Tell our listeners, what do you mean by that?
It was an exciting moment, I think, in responding and participating in the American lineage of the autobiography. That lineage begins with Herman Melville and Moby Dick, right in Nantucket. You know, people rarely write of Moby Dick as an autobiographical book, but it is. Herman lived that life. And so I think I'm participating in a lineage that I was dropped into, and a lineage, an American lineage that I'm inspired by, where the I, the historical I, is malleable. It can be tested and transformed through fiction and the imagination. And it's no wonder that Melville's contemporary was Walt Whitman, who says, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I contain multitudes. And that idea of multitudinous was so vital to American life. And now, in the hands of myself, a queer Asian American writer, the idea of a multiplicity towards thinking and being in this country is incredibly inspiring and enriching. And I think to start with who we are, the truth gets us in the room, and it's up to us to decorate it on our own terms. And that's art.
There are so many things I want to unpack from what you just said. Let me just hit two of them. The first, you talked about the American lineage of the autobiography. And it's clear that this book is at least semi-autobiographical, but it is a novel. So why is it a novel? Why did you not write pure autobiography?
Yeah, it's important because I think agency as an artist is very important for me. And going back to the lineage, you know, we began, the American inspiration is that one can create one's mythology for oneself. you know, this is the dream. This is the dream of Western expansion. And when it comes to policy on the ground, what became a dream ended up as violence and genocide and environmental collapse in our Western expansion with Manifest Destiny. But when it came to literature, where the power and the negotiation was always with language, it was incredibly potent space to reinvent oneself towards fiction. And I think what inspired me was that when you write a novel that's based on life, what you're creating is the ghost before the flesh. Often we think of ghosts as what is what remains once the body leaves. But when you write a novel, you're writing a future. You're writing a futurity, a reality and a world based on your life, but one you've never really lived, right? Never truly enacted down to the T. And that negotiation was incredibly powerful for me as an artist. Because the novel before that, in the hands of Tolstoy and Turgenev, the great Russian writers, and all those folks, it was part of the large scope of a stage. And I wanted to blend the borders to say that American life is inspiring for art. We don't have to aim for timelessness. We can put CVS in there. We can put fentanyl and opioids in there because that's what we're dealing with. We can put Dunkin' Donuts in there because it becomes a time capsule and a map of thinking and feeling as a way of informing the imagination.
You said a couple of minutes ago, you talked about the multiplicity of life and of identity. One of the things that struck me in reading the book as a reader was the intersectionality in the book is so striking. You've got poverty meets immigration meets oxy and fentanyl and heroin meets, as you've noted, queer bodies meets the Vietnam War meets New England. Mm-hmm. In reading the book, it seems that it's to get the full power of your art, to use your term. You have to be able to embrace and sort of take in all of those identities at once. Yeah. But is this also a story where one could come to it from one of those places? You know, someone, a Vietnamese immigrant, or someone who's queer, or someone who's experienced poverty in the Northeast. Do you have to take it all in at once, or can you appreciate the art taking in a piece of it at a time?
Yeah, I think that's the joy of the reader's participation. It's up to them. I would say that for me, the novel in the Western tradition asks of us to have a linear plot, one that uses conflict to progress the story. And great literature has been created that way, but one of the pitfalls is that conflict-driven plot becomes almost its own protagonist, where people are fed into the wood chipper of plot, and they become props. And I think for me, it was more important to surrender or even refuse plot in order to gain people. You know, in this book, there's white agrarian farmers, there's Vietnamese refugees and immigrants, there's Dominican immigrants living in the intersections of Hartford, there's queer bodies, there's poor bodies, there's rich bodies. I think I didn't want to compromise one label over another because American life is that complicated and that rich. And instead of a linear plot, I saw this book like a flower. Every petal is its own thing, but it requires all of the petals blooming in unison to create a rose. And I think that's what American life is.
You talk about Rose. You talk about the mother character. I'd like to have you read a small portion from the start of the book, both because it's a set of memories of her that are complicated, but also because I want listeners to be able to get a feel for the flow and the art and really the poetry inside this novel. Mm-hmm. This is from the start of the book for our listeners.
Sure. The time we went to Goodwill and piled the cart with items that had a yellow tag, because on that day a yellow tag meant an additional 50% off. I pushed a cart and leaped on the back bar, gliding, feeling rich with our bounty of discarded treasures. It was your birthday. We were splurging. "Do I look like a real American?" you said, pressing a white dress to your length. It was slightly too formal for you to have any occasion to wear, yet casual enough to hold a possibility of use, a chance. I nodded, grinning. The cart was so full by then I no longer saw what was ahead of me. The time with the kitchen knife, the one you picked up, then put down, shaking, saying quietly, "Get out, get out." And I ran out the door, down the black summer streets. I ran until I forgot I was 10, until my heartbeat was all I could hear of myself.
In this book, you have these moments often juxtaposed of horrifying abuse or terror or tragedy, and then intimacy and joy and beauty. Are those petals on the flower, to use your metaphor, that have to coexist? Do they have to be side by side like that to fully appreciate them?
Yeah, proximity creates tension. And also, I wanted to enact, you know, mental illness and schizophrenia, which a lot of these women in this novel negotiate, having suffered the trauma of the war and living with mental illness, and that it's almost like switching channels on a TV. And at sometimes that could be horrific, but at times that could be quite beautiful, that when a moment gets really intense, the TV switches or the petal reveals itself, and now you're in a different, more merciful, sweet and tender balm. And that's what it's like. You know, there's no total immersion. It's just a constant flickering of hardness and beauty.
Tell us more about the women in this book. They loom so large and powerfully in the main character, Little Dog's life. Tell us about them.
I wanted to really take the advantage of the first-person narrative in the way Ishmael saw Ahab in Moby Dick, Nick Carraway saw Gatsby, in Junior saw Oscar Wilde in Junior Diaz. I felt that there's an opportunity to take the eye and turn it into a searchlight. And for me, it was to amplify the lives of these women. Often, it is the men who create the wars, and it's the women who clean it up. And they clean it up emotionally, psychically. They clean it up physically. They heal these broken bodies. And I think for me, the question was, at what cost? I didn't want to romanticize them into women warriors or heroes. I wanted to see, this is the cost when women lay their bodies on the line to recuperate entire families after a war. The cost is their own mental health, is their own joy. And then the question for me is, how do they find joy? How do they find it on their own terms? And it's not a spoiler that, for me, one of the proudest moments is that the book ends on the laughter of an Asian American woman.
Why does that make you feel so proud?
I don't think I've seen it before, you know, and that for a book full of language, for it to end on wordless joy, to me seems like such a feat to attempt.
One of the things that strikes me in the book, Rose, the character in the book, works in a nail salon, and your mom has worked in a nail salon. And the battering and the degradation of her health from working in a nail salon. I had a colleague at one point that did research on the long-term impacts of women working in nail salons because of the toxicity of the environment.
Yeah.
How is your mom?
Yeah.
How is she today?
Well, she has cancer. She has stage 4 breast cancer.
I'm sorry.
So it's all tied, you know, and it's common among nail salon workers. And this, again, we talk about the cost, the price, but she's incredibly proud. You know, she's able to see, you know, her life amplified, the people like her amplified in literature, which is a very, you know, it has a very noble position in American life. And for that to be casted there, it's an incredibly enriching moment for her. And I think for the first time, we're starting to see Vietnamese American working class life in America and asking about the second and third generation. Where do we go from here? We're starting to see that enacted in art and literature. And it's very exciting. She can see that. And so she's happy. You know, illness is a brutal teacher, and it teaches you how to live better. And you know, after her initial diagnosis, and now that she's on her meds and she's responding well, her life is better.
What else did you try to show or depict or tell the story of for the first time in this book?
One of the things that excited me, you know, as an opportunity in the novel was to show queerness, queer bodies, queer sex. Literature is often afraid or wary of showing the body in sex, in pleasure. For queer folks, that's often how we discover ourselves, and particularly in terms of failure. You know, in this book, there's multiple botched sex scenes, and Failure in America is often seen as something that we should hide. But for queer people, failure is a way forward. No one taught us the birds and the bees. You know, rarely do we get that conversation. And I would even say that one of the book's thesis is that failure is the first stage of innovation, which is so prominent in queer lives.
One of the characters in the book, Trevor, who Little Dog has his first sexual encounters with, also, it seems, represents a kind of masculinity that would in no way embrace failure.
Right.
So tell us about the meeting of those two sets of principles, this masculinity that says there is only strength in success or destruction.
Right.
And failure is how we find ourselves and find innovation.
It's easy to look at a character like Trevor, a poor, you know, white kid living in, you know, a mobile home with his father who's drunk. It's easy to call him redneck or hillbilly. But one thing I learned as an artist and a novelist is that the more you look at something, the more you free it away from its stereotypes. And as I looked at Trevor, I realized, wait a minute, what would happen if someone tried to free themselves from the cage of hegemonic masculinity? What would happen if a white boy started to say no to his own milieu, to betray his elders and breach tenderness? What happens if he does like sunflowers? What happens if he likes sunsets, tenderness, if he likes soft things, if he likes quiet conversation? What would it do? Can he survive it? What is the cost of someone trying to break free from a toxic cage? Can it happen? That was the major inquiry for me.
I don't think it's revealing too much for listeners to say that one thing that Trevor doesn't escape is the opioid crisis.
Right.
And there's something nearly journalistic about the way you are explicit in talking about that crisis, the manufacturing of Oxy, how it's unfolding. Why did you include such sharp detail about that crisis in a book that seems softer around the edges in so many other parts?
Right, right. The section on the opioid facts and Purdue Pharma arrive when the book starts to fall apart. And as you know, halfway through, the prose starts to fall away.
I noticed that.
Into line breaks and poetry. So I guess what happens is, what happens when the ground of fiction, the stage, the contrived aura of storytelling collapses? Often we think of a great American novel as something that is monolithic, is a bold tome of a statement of a generation. For me, my participation in the American novel had to deal with actual disintegration. And so when the book starts to disintegrate, the lyrical voice levitates and the facts stand on their own. Because after art, the facts remain. We can write a novel, we can create a piece of art, but the lives that are lost through policy, through capitalistic, you know, huge pharma that robbed so many futures in our region, those lives are always lost. And I wanted the novel to be a reckoning. I did not want to escape. I wanted the novel to slowly turn into a mirror of who we are. And that's who we are. Purdue Pharma started in Stamford, Connecticut, and it followed the routes of I-91 all the way up to Maine and down to Appalachia. That's what happened to us. And one of the opportunities of a novel is to be a map and a record of what it's like. You know, when we read The Odyssey, it's also an anthropological gem. When I read The Odyssey, I said, my goodness, back then, they slaughtered a lot of lambs. Every time something happened, 50 lambs were slaughtered. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it doesn't really do much for the book, but it helps you understand how these folks saw the world and what happened to them. And in the same way, you know, the opioid epidemic will be one of the legacies of New England. And I think one of the questions is, how do we find joy? How do we make it out of here?
We're talking with poet and writer Ocean Vuong. I'd love to have you read one more passage for our listeners. And this is, as you describe it, in a part of the book where the novel has started to fall apart. And there's a moment where Little Dog actually talks fairly self-consciously about writing. And I wonder if you could read that for our listeners.
Absolutely. You asked me what it's like to be a writer. And I'm giving you a mess. I know. But it's a mess, Ma. I'm not making this up. I made it down. That's what writing is. After all the nonsense, getting down so low, the world offers a merciful new angle, a larger vision made of small things. The lint, suddenly a huge sheet of fog, exactly the size of your eyeball.
What does it mean to get down so low? Yeah. And if you are getting down so low, how is this about tragedy without being tragic?
Right, right. Often we think of writing as elevated language. We think of poetry as elevation. And I think there's an odd vertical negotiation when we think of art making in the West, that something is on the peak. And I think this is why a lot of literature gets hauled into elitism and the ivory towers. And I think for me, literature coming from the oral tradition of our ancestors was part of life. And I want to reclaim that as something absolutely malleable. And life is tragic. Life is challenging. You know, one of the things that I'm proud of in this book is that there are no villains and no victims. And what I mean by that is that there are victims. There's victims of abuse, there's victims of drug abuse, of war. But I think whether we endure or experience victimhood is up to us. And language is the inquiry into that possibility for me.
You talk in that section about writing being a mess, essentially. You work with young writers today. You're on faculty at UMass Amherst. Yeah. I imagine students clamor to take your class. What would be your advice to young writers who might be listening today and might be inspired by what they're hearing from you?
A short bit would be, scare yourself, but don't be scared of yourself. Just negotiate fear as a reality of living and making art in this country. Often we're terrified of fear, but I think it's important because fear and doubt tells us that we care. Innately, we care so much that we want to get it right. So honor your fear, honor your doubt, turn doubt into a source of energy because it means you're respecting what you do.
That's Ocean Vuong, author of On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. He's a writer, a poet, and an assistant professor at UMass Amherst. Thanks for being at Radio Boston, Ocean.
Thank you so much. It's a deep pleasure.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.